Welcome to the Most High Show, a show about recovery, spirituality, and all that. Produced, posted, and hosted by people in recovery who have strength and hope and want to share it with you. If you or someone you love is suffering, we want you to know you are not alone. This is the Most High Show.
This is really a treat for me, Joseph. I'm really...
Yeah, it's nice to see you. I mean, I don't know, like, of course we're connected on Instagram, but we haven't actually, and Facebook rather, but we haven't seen each other face to face in many years.
So I know. I think the last time we were in the same room together, there were like fondue pots involved, if
yes.
I'm not mistaken. Well,
I'm sure.
We can leave out that,
okay,
that chapter for sure, but... yeah,
Do you know that I went on to manage a melting pot in D.C.?
No, I didn't know that. No.
Yeah, I did.
For how long?
Less than a year. It was a shit show. I was a mess.
Okay. So was I.
Yeah.
You know, because I went from North Carolina up to Detroit to help a friend of mine open up his franchise. And I think that was where I came pretty close to my... rock bottom.
Yeah.
You know, I went from, because I only lasted for a year there. And then I went from there down to South Florida, down to Fort Lauderdale, and was managing a restaurant there. And it wasn't too long until the jig was up there.
Yeah.
And then my last ditch effort was to come up to Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just a complete debacle. And I was let go of the company. From the company completely at that point. So all my ties were severed about 7 years now since I've been with that company any way. So I've had the privilege, though, of sort of witnessing your story. I'm clearly at a distance from social media distance, but it's been really interesting from my point of view to watch your struggles, your growth, your recovery, get to see the successes that you've had in recovery. So just taking it back, just and jump in and correct me.
Okay.
At any point during my introduction here.
Okay.
So I've known you now for almost 2 decades. And we were living together in the same sort of small town in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so already the social circles there are pretty small. But then when you get down into the LGBTQ community, it's even smaller. And then when you drill down into those of us who like to party, the circles get even smaller. So we had several friends in common.
Yeah.
And we actually worked together. For a period of time. And I'm putting together this timeline as much as I can because I've consumed a lot of alcohol and drugs between then and now. So I've got some black spots.
Yeah. There. It's all a blur.
Yeah, it is. Some of it is a blur, but you know, some of it's pretty crystal clear. Some of the parts I'm not really terribly comfortable with are pretty crystal clear, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And I've had to use those moments as a way to stay clean and sober today. So it gives me an opportunity to remember how it used to be. So I moved on from North Carolina and went to Detroit to sort of pursue this hospitality career that I thought I was going to have for a long time. And then where did you go from North Carolina?
Well, you know, I lived in North Carolina for all of my life until I was, I guess, 36, 37, something like that. And then I moved up to Washington, D.C. And it's funny, I actually moved to Washington, D.C. without a job. I had a little bit of money. I was coming out of a breakup with a really hard breakup that was the result of a number of things, but especially my inability to keep a job because of my drinking and drugging. But I ended up in D.C., and my whole purpose in moving to D.C. was to get away from my old patterns. I was doing a relocation.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah, and I was certain that I was going to move there and that I was going to be able to get my shit together. But unfortunately, I ended up, the job that I got was in management of the same restaurant chain we had worked at together. And restaurants and sobriety, at least in my case, just don't go together.
It's pretty tough.
Yeah. So there was not only that, but I also pretty quickly started seeing someone who did like his fair share of drinking and drugging, you know. And it's been a case with a number of my exes that somehow I ended up with in relationships with people who also drink and drugged, but were able to manage their repercussions much more successfully than I was.
Isn't that annoying that people can actually do that? Yeah. I've never been able to.
I've never been able to. But, you know, it's tough, though, because, like, you, when you're in that sort of relationship, you see your partner doing the same things, but then they still manage to, like, get up and go to work and do their job, you know? I mean, I realize now that there is much larger issues at play, such as I hated the things that I was trying to do as a job, you know? So, of course, I'm the kind of person that when I don't enjoy something, like, I'm pretty much just not going to do it.
Sure. But I spent a lot of time trying to convince myself that I was enjoying it, that I was okay with it. At least that's how it was for me. Just sort of lying to myself about this, the direction my life was going in, that everything was okay, that I was in control somehow.
You know, I don't know that I even had a semblance of that. Like, I felt very rudderless in life. And, you know, one thing that I'm very good at, I've discovered, is I'm very good at presenting myself and selling myself to others. So I, time after time, would end up in jobs that I wasn't really qualified for. Like, for instance, when I moved to D.C. and got the job managing this restaurant, I'd never managed a restaurant before. Like, I had been a waiter, but I'd never managed a restaurant before.
But you BS'd your way into it, right?
Yeah. After I got fired from there, I ended up applying for a job, a very entry-level job with a security firm. So a place that staffs security guards for buildings. And I started as basically a front desk person. And I worked my way into HR, and then I worked my way into a leadership position. And then the last 6 months I was there, I was their training manager for the entire city. So it was a pretty high-level, high-responsibility job that I just sort of BS'd my way into.
Now, during this time, were you still trying to manage a pretty significant drug and alcohol abuse lifestyle?
I was, yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my usage during this time was back and forth a lot. So I was able to get, I don't even know how to describe it well. When I was managing the restaurant, I was drinking every day, you know? Yeah. And it would end up getting through phases where it was heavier. And then my drinking would lead me into my other drugs of choice, which would be like speed-based substances, right? So I would sort of have these peaks and valleys of being able to manage it and then it being completely unmanageable. Yeah. Or so I thought, right? I thought I was managing it. It looked a little bit like I was managing it.
Sure.
And then the same thing in the job with the security firm. Like, for instance, when I remember there was one period when things got really bad, I managed to get myself into a federal leave, which they couldn't really ask questions about because it was a very by the book organization. So I requested this very certain kind of leave, which they couldn't ask questions about.
Brilliant.
It was really just
brilliant.
Because, yeah, it's because my life was a mess and I was trying to sort everything out, mm-hmm. right? But, you know, you can only play that game so long.
Sure. Just like the geographic game. So you, she made this geographic change to DC. Uh-huh. You got shit canned from the restaurant. You're at this securities firm.
Yeah.
You were let go from there, I assume?
I was let go from there, too. Okay. Yeah, I got fired from every job I've ever
okay.
had.
All right. So, so where did you go from there?
Well, I say this a lot. When I tell my story, I say I got fired from every job I ever had until I started doing yoga. Because, like, I didn't have a job that I cared about before. I think that's equally important to acknowledge in all of this process, at least for me. Like, a big part of the issue was not only, like, the drugs and alcohol were a symptom of so many other things. And for me, I discovered it's really important to find something to do with my life that I care about. Otherwise, I'm just going to BS it. Mm-hmm. Like I did in the restaurants, like I did in the security firm. But eventually, I got fired from the firm as well. And, you know, I was with someone at the time, and he was he was pretty financially secure. So, like, I didn't have immediate repercussions from that. And it was sort of after this happened that I started to spiral really seriously into the complete and total unmanageability of life. So once I was without a job, I started drinking and drugging more, you know, like I would disappear for a week at a time because I started using crystal meth. And I first used crystal meth back in North Carolina, and somehow it was sort of casual for a number of years. But then after I ended up in DC, there was like this slow escalation over a number of years where I went from sort of snorting crystal and then smoking it. And, you know, crystal meth has a really, really strong ability just to make you like forget about everything else. So I would disappear from the house for a week. And then I'd come back and, you know, I'd have to sleep it off for a couple of days. And this poor guy that I was with at the time, he tried so hard to help me. His background was actually in psychology. He was a doctor. So he had a lot of insight into what was going on with me. And, you know, I still reflect back and I think of some of the things he said to me. And I see now that he was really, like, doctoring what was going on with me. Like, he was trying very hard to help me. But I didn't want help,
right.
You know, I didn't want help at that point. And there came a point where he was from Brazil. He had to go home over the holidays. And while he was gone, something that had been in the back of my head for a long time was to try shooting up crystal meth. Yeah. So while he was gone, I decided to do this for the first time.
Why not? Nobody's paying. Nobody's watching.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And, you know, from there, it was a short path from there, from the first time I shot up to my complete rock bottom. It was about 6 months. And over that course of period, I, like, imploded my entire life. Like, he came back and... again, he was trying to help, but I just wasn't interested. And I realized that I just had to leave because he wasn't going to give up. And I knew that I wasn't going to give up the drugs then.
Right.
So I did, I left. And at that point I just had like a bag on my shoulders. And I mean, I was for all intents and purposes, homeless, you know, I had people who I was bouncing in and out of their houses.
And this is still in the D.C. area, correct?
Yeah, in D.C. Okay. All of this was in D.C. Yeah, and, you know, it's a... I don't know how much to get into all of this, but, you know, my usage at this time just kept going up. Basically, I ended up shooting up, like, regularly. And I ended up trying to sell drugs to... pay for that sort of habit because mm-hmm. it's not cheap. And at the end of the day, after some amount of time, I was really integrated into a situation with a dealer. So this guy I was seeing at the time and I, we had a close relationship with this dealer, and we knew where he had stashed some G, and we ended up stealing a very large stash of G, like jugs and jugs of it. And I managed to rent a SUV in my name, and basically I packed up everything I owned. And we took these jugs of GHB and we just left. We left DC.
Now, it's funny because I kind of know this part of the story, this little segment of the story, because you've posted this online. So, and again, correct me if I'm wrong. So you took this rental car.
Yeah.
And it's loaded with jugs of G that you've stolen from your drug dealer.
Yeah.
And then you guys just head south.
Yeah.
And you're all... you're flying high this whole time. You're just completely strung out. So you leave DC and now do you know you're going to Florida at this point?
Yeah, it's in the back of our head that we're going to head to Florida because, the guy I was seeing at the time knew some people here. So we left DC and we actually went first to Memphis, Tennessee, where he had some family. And we spent a couple weeks there, like a mess, trying to reconnect with them and also like selling some of the G that we had to connections he had there. And then when we had sort of burned all of our bridges there, we got back on the road and we headed towards Jacksonville, Florida, where again, he had more connections. We sold some G there and then we just bounced. We bounced from Jacksonville, we ended up in Tampa down to South Florida and Miami. And then once we got into Florida, we did this weird thing with the G where we just bounced back and forth a lot between Miami and Tampa. And, you know, it was actually with some good, like we had these ideas in our head of some good intentions, you know, and no matter what our intentions were, where it ended was that we ran out of the G, you know? So at the end of the day, there was no more G left and we were strung out and we were in this vehicle, which I had rented for a few days and kept for a couple months. They were sending letters to my family and my ex basically saying, we're going to charge this person with Grand Theft Auto if we don't get this vehicle back. And, you know, I was so strung out at this point that I had a lot of paranoia. And at the end of the day, it wasn't my fear that I was going to be charged with Grand Theft Auto or that I had stolen this vehicle. I developed this fear that somehow my boyfriend at the time was trying to steal the vehicle from me. I was just like so off my rocker that I decided that the best option, because he clearly was trying to steal this vehicle from me, was for me to finally call back the car rental agency and tell them to come get it. So that's what I did. And mind you, everything I owned is in this vehicle. So I called them. I was like, you need to send a tow truck to come get this. I pulled all of my stuff out. I set it on the curb in a parking lot. Like boxes and boxes of stuff. And they came and they towed away the truck. So then I'm just left there with all of my stuff on a curb in Tampa, Florida, with no idea what to do next, right? And somehow we managed to like extend things out a few more days by sort of just doing our thing where we were taking advantage of other people and getting them to help us, you know? Yeah. But at the end of the day, we had no more options. We had nowhere to go. And my boyfriend at the time made the decision that he was leaving. He called someone he knew in DC. He had a ticket bought for himself. He got in a taxi. He left and went to the airport. Now, mind you, this is someone who I'd spent like the last year of my life with in like this really strung out, drug-fueled state of mind. And he was just suddenly gone. And I was, that was my rock bottom, like being stuck on the curb in Tampa with all my stuff and no idea what to do.
So you've got no job, you've got no money, you have no partner, you have no home.
Yeah.
You have no form of transportation.
Yeah.
You're in the middle of Tampa.
And I was weeping. I was crying. I was just like heartbroken. And like every, like I had no idea what to do except for what I knew was always there as well.
Yeah.
And that was to call my sister and tell her that I needed help. So my sister and I have a lifelong, very challenging relationship. It's always been very hard. And, you know, when I started really heading down my path of serious addiction, it just got worse. Because she minces no words about calling me out on my shit. She was very brutal about it. But at the same time, I knew why she was being brutal. She was being brutal because our mom died from drugs, you know, and she saw the same thing coming for me. So when all other options were lost and I knew that there was nowhere else to turn, I called my sister.
And where is she? Where is she at the time?
She's in North Carolina.
So did she physically come to where you were?
No, okay. No. She and my aunt came together and they bought me a hotel room for that night. And they bought me a plane ticket for the next day.
Back to North Carolina. NC. Okay. Yes. So you went back to North Carolina for a while.
Yeah, I went back to North Carolina and I was staying with my family there. And I started the first real stint of sobriety that I'd had in a very long time.
Did you get into, was there a 12-step program you tried to get into? Or how did you try to maintain a sobriety?
Well, you know, 12-step and I have a long fraught history because, you know, as I just mentioned, my mom was an addict, lifelong addict, and her addiction killed her. And, you know, I saw her through her entire life come in and out of meetings. Mm-hmm. I remember as a child going with her to some meetings. So I had a couple of thoughts. My thought was it didn't work because she died, right? So that was one of my thoughts. And my other thought was that it just wasn't for me because I have absolutely no relationship to the Judeo-Christian background that I feel the program is presupposed on.
Okay.
And, you know, that's a matter of long discussion. I do still believe the program has that. I believe it has some openness to other ideas. But I do believe fundamentally that its founders believed that Christianity was like the way to go, the way to turn to get over your addiction. So in any case, my point is I was in and out of meetings. Even from the time I was in DC, I would try to go, but I never got a sponsor. Like I had people who were trying to guide me, but I never asked anyone to sponsor me. I wasn't ready to like give that much to someone else. I wasn't ready to turn it over yet. And even when I got to North Carolina, you know, part of the agreement between my sister and I is that I come to North Carolina and that she was getting me into a inpatient program. You know, she was like, you can come, but you have to do something inpatient. So we tried that, and I got in an inpatient program, and within a couple of days, I have another health issue where it's called vasovagal. Basically, it's where sometimes my blood pressure regulation causes me to pass out suddenly. I've had it my entire life.
So my second day there,
I had one of these episodes, and they had to call an ambulance. And because of that, once I was removed, I couldn't go back in.
Ugh, the drama.
Yeah. So I was out of that program. And, you know, I still, though, without actually getting into any formal recovery programs, I managed to get sober for a good long time.
How long?
From the time my sister picked me up until my next relapse, I think was about 9 or 10 months.
So when you relapsed, did you relapse back on alcohol alone or both alcohol and drugs?
Both.
Okay.
Both.
And how long did that stint last?
A few days.
Okay.
So, yeah. So I got about 9 months. I ended up going from North Carolina to Tennessee, where my aunt lived in the middle of bumfuck nowhere.
Ugh.
And my ex, the one who had left me in Florida, he had gone back to D.C. and started using heavily again. So, again, he was in a desperate situation. He ended up coming to Tennessee, where I was. And we both managed to get a good stint of sobriety under the watch of my aunt, who is a force of nature. She did a lot to help us during that time. She helped keep a roof over our head. She provided a sort of stability that we really needed. And we got, for both of us, the first big chunk of sobriety we'd gotten in a long time. But the problem was we were in the middle of BFE. And after some time, we decided that we needed to get out of there. Because it was the kind of place, I wrote recently about this, it's the kind of place where the two of us, without touching each other or holding hands or doing anything outwardly apparent, like big redneck pickup trucks would do a slow roll by and just glare at you and say, faggots.
Sure.
You know, this sort of really country redneck thing. It just wasn't a place where we were meant to be. We were completely out of place there.
Well, would you say that while you were there with your aunt, would you say that you wanted to get clean and sober for yourself?
Oh, absolutely. Like,
really wanted it.
Really wanted
so,
it.
So you left BFE.
Yeah.
And you went.
And we went to Asheville. We were like, Asheville wasn't too far from where we were in Tennessee. It was in the middle of my sister and my aunt. So we went to Asheville. But without that structure, without someone there watching over us, we started drinking again, and it wasn't long at all before we started smoking weed, and then it wasn't long before, again, we had come into meth.
Yeah, it's pretty, from what I understand, it's pretty prevalent there.
It's prevalent everywhere.
Yeah, it is. It is, yeah. Really, it's really decimated so many communities, and really just the gay community. It's just unrecognizable to me these days because it is so, it's really just.
Well, you know, I feel like I really, like it's just so easy to find anywhere you go. Like if you go into any sort of gay app or there are even services out there that are really geared towards unhealthy relationships and unhealthy sexual relationships, you know, like there's Grindr, of course, but then there are other sites which are just like Grindr, but totally geared towards unhealthy behaviors and relationships, you know, and
there are chemsex sites available out there.
Yeah.
That so if that's what you're looking for, it's easy to find.
Yeah. And even on Grindr, you just have to go in and like put in certain keywords and everything just comes. Right.
Correct. And for those of you who aren't familiar with that, Grindr is, it sets itself up to appear as a dating site, but really ultimately I know that it is it's prominently a hookup site. And, there's quite a saturation of drug addicts on there that like to pair up and practice chemsex. And that's really what it is. You know, I go to a clubhouse here in Atlanta and, you know, we have our AA meetings, but I also see the CMA meetings, the Crystal Meth Anonymous meetings. And those are typically every meeting they have is wall to wall standing room only.
Yeah.
And so you've really just seen how it's just blown up, not just regular communities, but in particular, the gay community. So picking back up with your story, if we may. So you leave BFE, you go to Asheville, you end up using again.
Yep, we end up using again. We end up getting sober again. My boyfriend at the time decided that he wanted to enroll in mortuary school, which was a lifetime ambition, lifetime intention of his. So he applied for and got into a program in Miami, actually, a really well-respected program. So again, we up and moved, and we moved down here to South Beach. Again, with a little bit of money in our pockets, neither one of us really with jobs in store. But we got here and we found ways to make it work.
And that was how long ago, Joseph?
That was going on 7 years now, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah. So we got here and...
Did you have a place to live?
No, we had some temporary things lined up.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a series of fortunate events wherein, you know, during the course of my usage, I think it's important to recognize that my introduction to yoga happened back when I was in D.C. And when I wasn't using, when I managed to get some sobriety, I would start going to yoga classes.
What about it appealed to you at the beginning?
The yoga?
Yeah.
It was a physical, it was something I could concentrate on. Like it was a physical activity that brought me a sense of satisfaction and I would even say a yoga high. You know, I definitely, even to this day, I will recognize and acknowledge the power of the yoga high as something that helped me get outside of the high of drugs and alcohol. So the sort of euphoric feeling that I would get at the end of a yoga class really resonated with my addictive personality.
Of course.
You know? And I think that's okay. It's okay to replace one bad addiction with one addiction it's still an addiction, but it's not going to kill you.
It's a little healthier, Joseph.
Yeah, it's a little healthier. So I started going back and forth between these two sort of addictions. And, you know, part of my story was trying to do rehab programs in D.C. and they never quite worked for me. I would try going to meetings. They never quite worked for me. So eventually I was like, I'm going to go to India and I'm going to do a yoga teacher training. So that's what I did. Long before North Carolina or Florida, I went to India, and I did this teacher training program, which mind you, I still somehow drank through a little bit. But by the time I got to DC, to Miami, I had this in my back pocket that I had this certification to teach yoga. And I applied for a job at a gay hotel, actually. And they hired me to be a cleaner. I got a job cleaning this hotel, but they said once the hotel got a little established that they wanted me to start teaching yoga classes too. Because it was brand new. When I started working, it hadn't even opened yet. So our good fortune was that I got a job at a hotel, and these very nice people who owned it initially let us stay in one of the rooms before the hotel actually opened. And then they connected us with a friend of theirs who was renting a room. So we ended up finding some stability.
Good.
And that stability led us into the Sobe room, which was my first serious commitment to a 12-step program. I ended up in this room called the Sobe room, which to me felt completely different than any other room or 12-step situation I'd been in. I think as a product of it being in South Beach, it's very, very liberal. Like, it's full of gay people. It's full of all sorts of religious beliefs and diversity. I felt like it was okay for me to choose a sponsor who I really connected with, who was a woman, which is, I always understood was something I wasn't allowed to do, you know? So I ended up in this room and working the program for the very first time. And it was amazing. Like, I had a sponsor who really allowed me to have all my doubts about the program, all my doubts about Christianity, and who worked really hard with me to find the program, the parts of the programs that were going to save my life.
So as you're growing in recovery, your yoga practice and your yoga career really start to take off, and that,
yeah,
that becomes a huge preoccupation in,
yeah,
in your life.
Yeah.
Correct? So you start teaching yoga at this hotel, correct?
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How long were you doing that before you moved on to what you're doing now?
Well, you know, I taught yoga at that hotel for probably 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, I was also cleaning there for a while. And as I started to build up my confidence teaching the classes there, I started to feel like maybe I could apply to teach yoga at a gym, you know? So I did that. And I ended up getting a position teaching at a gym here. And I ended up getting a lot of classes. So between the hotel and this gym I was teaching at, I ended up having more yoga than I could teach. You know, there was more classes than I could handle. So I ended up coming out of the cleaning position. I also was able to develop my personal practice to a whole new degree. There's a huge correlation and interrelation between yoga philosophy and recovery philosophy. And I had the very good fortune of ending up in a traditional yoga studio here in Miami, a place called Miami Life Center,
mm-hmm,
which is focused on like the typical yoga class that you're familiar with, but also in the traditional Indian philosophy, right? So I ended up in this studio and studying with teachers there who weren't just fitness instructors, but who were spiritual seekers, you know?
Which is the part that we miss, that we're missing,
yeah,
for so many years. And you,
yeah,
you were able to find that sort of spiritual peace in the Miami,
yeah,
Life Center.
Exactly. And you know what, in the rooms, it was very hard for me to connect to this spiritual peace because like I have this deeply held aversion to the power structures of religion,
sure,
you know?
And that's relatively common.
It was very hard for me to surrender, like even into some of the step work. Like I had to very much so create a God of my understanding that was not theistic, you know. So it's an irony almost. I'll say that it's an irony that my life has ended up entrenched and more or less saved by two different programs that are really built around a spiritual sort of revolution in the individual. But the good thing about the yoga program is that it was so foreign to me that I was able to really give in a little bit to the components of higher power and that I wasn't able to give into with recovery. So I had the good fortune. I ended up at this studio and, you know, I ended up doing a course of study with them that really taught me explicitly the interconnections between yoga and recovery. And even like I started studying the Yoga Sutras, and I have on my shirt here, I don't know if you can see that.
I can see it crystal clear.
It says, "Now it begins." Mm-hmm. So the Yoga Sutras are sort of like, I guess you could, they're an ancient philosophical text, and I guess you could say they're the big book of yoga. They're what we base our program off of.
Okay.
And the very first Yoga Sutra in Sanskrit says, "Atta Yoga Anusthasanam," and that translates to "Now is the time for yoga," right? And even that very first sentence has such a strong correlation to recovery philosophy, because in recovery we know we're not ready till we're ready. You know, we have to go through all of the shit that gets us to our place where we're ready to surrender, right?
Right.
And that's the exact same thing that the very first sentence of yoga says. It says now, and the now is so pregnant and full of meaning. Like, now yoga begins. Now it begins because of all this other shit that happened in your life, you know? It's a very deceptively simple way to start a spiritual text, mm-hmm. but it's very poignant to me.
And it's clearly been the silver bullet for your life in general, in particular, your recovery.
Yeah,
and absolutely. I'll tell you, it's been really cool from my point of view, watching your transformation. I mean, obviously your physical transformation over the years, yes. but just your spiritual transformation, your professional growth. And I'm really grateful that you have been relatively candid online about the journey that you've had, finding your way into both the rooms of recovery and yoga, and then applying those to your life and finding a pretty firm foundation that you're standing on today.
Yeah. And you know, I want to say as well that like one of my favorite things that I did get out of 12-step recovery was the way that it teaches the person in recovery that they have something of value to offer the community. You know, like as soon as possible, we start teaching newcomers that you have something of value. Like, you can pick up the piece of trash. You can straighten that chair.
You can make coffee.
You can take this commitment.
Yeah.
And basically, that's the program telling you, you have value. There's something of value in you. And then we take it a bit further and we say that if you want to keep it, you have to give it away. If you want to keep the sobriety you've gotten, then you have to find a way to share that with others. And I think that that's one of the biggest driving forces in what I do, is that I know that I stay sober today because I have such a passion for yoga. I believe that yoga and recovery saved my life. And I think that I could, if I don't keep giving it away, then I could lose everything that I've achieved.
Absolutely.
Like that.
So if someone wants to learn more about your story, more about your yoga practice, what's the easiest way for them to find that online?
Yeah, so the best way to connect with me online is through Instagram.
Okay.
So on Instagram, I'm Joseph Armstrong Yoga. And I'm teaching a lot online right now. One of the silver linings of this whole COVID situation is that the yoga community has taken everything online. Mm-hmm. So I just taught a 3-week series in which I really delved into the connections between recovery philosophy and yoga philosophy. I'm teaching daily yoga classes. I have a number of workshops upcoming. And I also can do one-on-one lessons there. So if anyone wants to know more about yoga and recovery and how to heal through this spiritual practice, you can find me there.
Okay. And we'll post that information on our platforms as well to make it easier for people to find you. It's been great talking to you. I appreciate you sharing your story. I appreciate you, first of all, just answering my text a couple of weeks ago, but agreeing to come on here and tell us and fill in some blanks for me that I haven't been quite sure about over the last couple of years. But it's such a thrill to see that you're in a good place today, Joseph.
Yeah, well, I'm honored. Like, it's my privilege to come here and to share about what's happened. So it's,
how lucky are we, man? How lucky are we?
Yeah, I know. I know. Next month is going to be 6 years for me. And
congratulations.
That's insane.
Yep. You're a miracle. You're a miracle. Yeah, I'm absolutely. Really proud of you, Joseph. Thank you very much for joining us
today.
Thank you. We'll talk to you, and we will see you guys really soon.